This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, we'll hear about a new book that details the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage in the U.S. Joining me first, Ambassador Dennis Ross, the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's been a special assistant to President Obama and a special advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He negotiated the Middle East peace process for more than 12 years in both the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations. Ambassador Ross is going to be in Cincinnati later this month to speak at the annual meeting of the Jewish Federation of Cincinnati. Also with us today, John Youkilis. He is past president and board member of the Jewish Community Relations Council and a former Brooklyn, New York assistant district attorney and president of the Victor Corporation. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dennis and John, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John, as way of introduction here, tell us some about Ambassador Ross and why he's been picked to be the speaker at this year's annual event.
Well, thanks, Mark. As you noted, Ambassador Ross is extremely distinguished and as widely experienced in negotiating on the front lines in the Middle East as any American diplomat that I certainly know of, and we're honored that he's joining us for the annual meeting for the Jewish Community Relations Council next week.
And Dennis, would you tell us some about the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the work that it does, and its mission?
Well, the essence of its mission is to define what are American interests in the Middle East and how best to pursue them. It has a range of expertise. We have people who are specialists on Arab politics. We have several people who are specialists on Iran. We have energy experts. We have terrorism experts. We have people who worked on the issue of peace between Arabs and Israelis and Palestinians. So we really cover the very wide gamut of the challenges that the Middle East is presenting, and obviously those challenges have become both more diverse, more comprehensive, and more complicated, and they become more and more of a focal point of America's national security and the threats to it, particularly in recent years.
Dennis, now you worked with the George H.W. Bush administration, the Bill Clinton administration for about a dozen years, negotiating in the Middle East peace process. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role that you played in that Middle East peace process?
Well, I was really the in the George H.W. Bush administration, Bush 41. I was one of Secretary Baker's closest aides and advisors. I headed the policy planning staff, but I was really given the kind of responsibility for Soviet-related policies and also broad policies in the Middle East, particularly Arab-Israeli policies. I helped conceptualize the approach to what we would do in the aftermath of the first Gulf War. I was worked very closely with Secretary Baker in terms of putting together the first Gulf War coalition, and then was with him every step of the way as we put together what became the Madrid Peace Conference, whose real purpose was to break the taboo on direct talks between Arabs and Israelis. And then, unexpectedly, I was asked, after being asked to stay on a transitional basis just to help with the handoff from the Bush to the Clinton administrations on an array of different issues, at a time when I was getting ready to leave in June of 1993, President Clinton and Secretary Christopher asked if I would remain as the chief negotiator, the chief envoy on Arab-Israeli issues. And so I ended up staying for the whole Bill Clinton administration as our chief negotiator in the Middle East.
We always hear this referred to as the Middle East peace process. So it's ongoing. It's been ongoing for a long time.
Right.
What do you see as some of the key challenges to creating a lasting peace in the region?
Well, one of the problems we face today is there is no process. For many years, in fact, there was a process. It was a process of negotiations. It was a process of trying to find ways to produce agreements, even if they were limited agreements, and build on those to see if you could produce something that was more comprehensive. We have had no negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians for an extended period of time now, so there actually is no process, and it has contributed to an increasing level of disbelief between Israelis and Palestinians. There's an irony here. One of the things that I think is probably the devil of the Palestinians as much as anything is that given all the other challenges in the region, you have a humanitarian catastrophe in Syria and the war there. You have the Iraqi government battling ISIS. You have a war in Yemen. You have challenges in Egypt by radical Islamists. You have a full-fledged war of militias and tribes and competing governments or regimes in Libya. So you have an array of different conflicts that really revolve around who's going to define and control identity, and it has consumed the attention of almost everybody in the region so that they're not paying attention to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Historically, that was oftentimes defined as a central conflict in the region and everything revolved around it. We can't say that today. And in a strange way, it actually creates an opportunity because if people aren't paying attention to it, it creates a certain space to make decisions. Unfortunately, given the level of disbelief between Israelis and Palestinians about the other's purposes, you really don't have much going on at this point. And I think the real challenge to change things between Israelis and Palestinians is to find, in the first instance, a way to reconnect the two sides and convince each side that the other actually is committed to a two-state outcome. That's no small challenge right now.
And it sounds to some extent like what you're describing, Dennis. Instability is the word that comes to my mind. Is it fair to say that instability in the region is just playing it's a key obstacle to this process?
For sure. You know, look, I have a book out now called Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israeli Relationship from Truman to Obama. And I deal with every administration from Truman to Obama and what they faced. I think it's fair to say what we see in the region today is more of a severe challenge or set of challenges than we've seen before, because any one of them by themselves might be sufficient to consume an administration, but you have all of these taking place at the same time. One of our problems has been, from Truman until today, is we frequently have simply misread the priorities of Arab leaders. That's one of the things I go over and outline. It's just as true today as it's been at different points, in some ways more true. You have the President of the United States who wants the priority to be ISIS, but you have those Arab leaders who are focused far more on Iran. We may not always have to accept the priorities of the local leaders, but we better understand them if we want to shape policies that have any chance of being effective.
Dennis, this is John. Is there a tacit alliance between even Prime Minister Netanyahu's government and the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and even the Saudis at this point, given the nuclear agreement with Iran and Iran's involvement, particularly on the ground in Syria?
I would say that you have a convergence of strategic interests that is more profound and more pronounced than anything we've ever seen between Israel and the Sunni Arab states. The Sunni Arab states see Israel as a bulwark against Iran. If you were the Saudis or the Emiratis or the Kuwaitis, you see the Israelis as a bulwark against the Iranians. If you're Egypt and Jordan, you see them as a bulwark and a natural partner against radical Islamist threats that can be both Sunni and Shia in character. And so that does create the basis for a level of cooperation below the radar screen that is unprecedented. Now, it's below the radar screen because the Palestinian issue is still an issue that resonates in the region as an issue related to basic justice. And so the Sunni Arab governments are prepared to cooperate quietly with the Israelis because it addresses their security concerns. They're not really prepared to cooperate in public unless the Palestinian issue can be addressed. And at this point, it's hard to address it based on where the Palestinians themselves are. I mean, they're weak, they're divided, they're highly dysfunctional, but they're positioning themselves for succession. So this kind of tacit set of cooperative arrangements, which are quite meaningful and quite real but are still tacit, are difficult to translate into something that's more enduring and more public. without an approach to the Palestinian issue, and yet the Arabs themselves, perhaps with Israel, could take on a different approach than we've seen in the past, or at least they could play a different role than they've played in the past.
Dennis, again, it goes back to the word process. Is there ever a possibility that this region sees lasting peace? I mean, what are your hopes for that?
Well, people always think that I'm a kind of inveterate optimist because, after all, I've spent the last 30 years trying to resolve the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. So obviously, I'm someone who always believes there's a way forward, even if the circumstances are difficult. Having said that, you know, we're not on the brink of any kind of lasting peace or any kind of breakthrough. We do have a landscape that is different because of this convergence of interest between the Sunni Arab states and their leaderships and the Israelis. And the question is, can we create some kind of new approach that combines the Arabs with the Palestinians working with the Israelis to try to create a breakthrough that way? And I would say there is some potential for that, probably not with the Obama administration, because there just isn't a high enough level of trust right now between the Arab states, because they feel that President Obama has been too willing, in a sense, to look at the Iranians as someone that one might be able to do business with, and they just don't see it that way. And so I think it's hard to get beyond that impediment at this point. But I do think the new strategic landscape creates some possibilities. There shouldn't be any illusions. The key Arab states, if they're going to do something on behalf of the Palestinians, will not do it on the cheap. They'll want to try to show that they could produce for the Palestinians what the Palestinians weren't able to produce for themselves. So it does require Israel to take steps that would be credible towards the Palestinians. But that would also, from an Israeli perspective, require the Arab states to reciprocate in terms of a kind of meaningful response that would make it worth Israel's while. So this is a long-winded way of saying I don't think we're on the cusp of a real breakthrough towards peace, but I think there are some circumstances that could be cultivated that could give you a chance to produce a breakthrough, maybe not now, but in a year or two.
Dennis, do you think that the problems in the region, for many of us in the United States, they seem to have been going on for our entire lifetimes. Is most of the U.S. population to the point where they tune it out unless something major, some major crisis occurs in the region?
I think the answer to that is yes. I mean, they're kind of inured to the conflict because there seems to have been so much of it. But I think they're also mindful of the potential threat that emanates from the Middle East. It's not just that we experienced 9/11. You know, it's that we're seeing ISIS either inspire attacks, as we saw probably in Orlando and maybe San Bernardino. They weren't behind them, but they represent a brand. They call on these lone wolves to carry out attacks. They say they can become heroic martyrs. They try to create this kind of model of responding to the indignities that they say that Islam has suffered, and this is the answer to it. So, you know, if you're sitting here in America and you look at these conflicts that look like they're never going to end on the one hand, and yet on the other, you realize that we can't insulate ourselves from them. And so we have to find a way to not just set back ISIS, but to defeat it. And I think that gives the American public an interest in the Middle East. It doesn't allow us to, in a sense, distance ourselves from it. I don't think that, you know, you look at the two prospective candidates for the presidency, you really have to ask the question, who tends to understand the realities of the region, who understands that we'll actually have to be engaged in it, even if it's quite messy, and who sort of has the understanding and temperament to deal with it.
Is there a way to engage more people in the U.S. to think about the problems that are occurring in the area and push for a solution?
Very interesting question. When you go back and you look at the ISIS beheadings, we're looking at, and we had two Americans who were beheaded. 94% of the American public was aware of that. I don't think there's any issue, no issue in pop culture, that 94% of the public is aware of it. So it tells you that there is a kind of awareness, and it tells you that at least for those who would like to be supportive of American approaches that might contribute to change in the region, I think that there is a wellspring there that one could draw on.
I'd just like to add that one of the parts of the mission of the Jewish Community Relations Council is education. And that's why we're so happy to have Ambassador Ross joining us next week, because we feel as Americans it's very important that the general community, not just the Jewish community, is educated about the convergence of interests for both Israel and the United States in the Middle East, and how American interests and the interests of Israel converge, not always, but in many cases. And that's why we're looking forward to his talk next week, and we're always engaged in this kind of activity here locally in terms of trying to advocate and educate the public on concerns, American concerns in the region.
Dennis, I want to go back to the – go ahead, Dennis.
Can I add one point on that? You know, it's whatever differences we have with Israel from time to time, they're really dwarfed by the shared values and the shared interests we have. And one of the reasons the title of the book is called Doomed to Succeed is not because the relationship has always been so rosy, but because of those shared values and shared interests and also shared threats. Those who threaten Israel tend to threaten us and vice versa. And when you look at the region itself right now, the region is going to be characterized by turmoil and conflict for some extended period of time to come, because, as I was saying earlier, it really is conflict over identity and who's going to shape it and who's going to own it. Well, in Israel will stand in pretty sharp contrast to that, to the turmoil, the uncertainty, and a lot of the unpredictability that that it characterizes the Middle East and its conflicts today.
Now, how have various administrations, what approaches, because we were talking earlier about the how there a lot is not really new since Israel's creation. But how the various administrations since Truman forward, how have they dealt with it? What are the various different approaches they've used, Dennis?
Well, there's been one of the striking things is that the presidents oftentimes feel like their predecessors just got it wrong. And so then you'll oftentimes see them try to demonstrate how different they will be from their predecessors. Eisenhower was very different from Truman. He thought Truman was too close to Israel, and so he wanted a distance from Israel. Kennedy came in and thought that everything that Eisenhower had done had been a complete failure. Everything he'd set out to do in terms of trying to attract the Arabs produced exactly the opposite effect. So he decided he would, on the one hand, he would reach out to the Arab nationalist forces. Later on, he was the first president to provide a weapon system to Israel. The pattern is repeated over and over again. In the case of President Obama, he felt that George W. Bush made a range of different mistakes. He thought that he created the impression that we were at war with Islam, so he wanted to show how different he was from President Bush. This imagery of presidents feeling that their predecessor got it wrong is kind of an interesting imagery, and it's also, ironically, it's contributed to the fact that instead of taking a hard look and say, all right, what did they get wrong? Why did they get it wrong? How did they get it wrong? And what lessons do we learn from that? There's been more of an instinct or an impulse just to try to say, I'm going to do it differently without asking a harder question about, well, maybe they didn't get it all wrong. Maybe they got some of it wrong, but maybe they got some of it right. And what's been consistent is a belief that the Middle East was important to American interests and would affect them. What wasn't consistent was how American presidents approached the region. Sometimes the pendulum would swing instead of only in a modest way, it would swing in a kind of dramatic way, and then you find the next president then feeling, all right, look, let me see if I can find some sort of stronger footing under which we will approach the region.
As President Obama nears the end of his final term in office, what do you think he needs to do? What do you think he needs to look at in regards to Israel?
Well, I think President Obama has been very good towards Israel when it comes to its security. I think he's, when it comes to the peace issue, he was convinced that basically, in a lot of ways, he knew better than the Israelis did of what it took. And in the course of that, he ultimately alienated the Israeli public, which is, if you really want to get things done with Israel, making sure the public feels that you understand Israel's predicament is probably the place to start, and that was something the president did not do. He also, at the same time, pretty much created a sense that that because the Palestinians were weak, he didn't expect much of them. But once he conveyed that image, they didn't expect much of them. They felt they were left off the hook, and they didn't have to do anything. So in a lot of ways, I think if I were going to suggest that the president do something differently between now and the end of the term, when there's obviously not a lot of time left, I would like to see him conclude. There's a 10-year memorandum of understanding on Israeli security, which he inherited from George W. Bush, and now that is about to expire. So I'd like to see that concluded before the end of the year, because that would be consistent with his approach on security. And I would like him to emphasize to the Palestinians, it's important for the Palestinians as well as the Israelis. I mean, at the same time that he does, he acts on the security, I think he should be saying to both, this is a good time for each of you to try to demonstrate to each other and the international community what you are prepared to do to demonstrate that your words about support for a two-state outcome are matched by your deeds. I think that would be a useful way to deal with both between now and the end of the term. One of the problems has been that the president, I think, is so preoccupied with ISIS that he's not doing a lot else in the region. And I think it's going to be difficult to get what he wants vis-a-vis ISIS beyond where we are unless he can attract the Sunni Arab states to do more. And he'll find it difficult to do that without being prepared to press the Iranians harder on the kind of steps they're taking in Iraq, which are counterproductive to building a more inclusive governance there, which will help get the Sunnis to fight ISIS, and unless he's prepared to do more to make it clear to the Russians and the Iranians that we'll raise the price to them of what they're doing in Syria. They are the ones who are making it harder and harder to pursue anything that would be a political process or any kind of political transition. So it's a heavy agenda, even though there's not many months left, but it's an agenda that's important because it can at least improve the landscape at a time for when the next president comes in.
How do you think the recent Iran nuclear deal, what kind of impact do you think that that's had on the relationship between the U.S. and Israel?
Well, I mean, this is one that obviously created problems from both ends. On the one hand, the fact that the Israelis fought it so openly and the Prime Minister of Israel came and gave a speech to the Congress, I think it tended to sharpen partisan differences. And, you know, for many Democrats, it made it appear as if the Prime Minister of Israel was not maintaining the nonpartisan posture, that all historic Israeli prime ministers have tended to adopt. So that, I think, soured and certainly affected the perception of this Israeli government on the part of many of the Democrats on the Hill. The flip side of that is that most Israelis felt that the deal was one that was quite favorable to Iran, that it's, while it constrained the Iranian nuclear program, it allows the Iranians to have a very large nuclear infrastructure. And after 15 years, there's no limitation whatsoever in the size of the nuclear industrial program the Iranians can build. So there was a deep suspicion in Israel, and certainly among many of the Arab states, that this was conferring on the Iranians a kind of power and the potential maybe to constrain their nuclear program, but not to have them actually give up their nuclear weapon intentions. But I think what you see is there was a gap between us and the Israelis in terms of how to look at this. The Israelis see the Iranian nuclear program as a kind of existential threat. The Obama administration looked at the negotiations as their vehicle for basically holding off or restraining the Iranian nuclear program through diplomatic means, and that was better than any alternative that was available. I think in the first term, the administration did a better job of its dialogue with the Israelis. In the second term, the Israelis frequently felt surprised by what they were discovering about what the administration was doing with the Iranians.
So, Dennis, looking years out, not just to the end of President Obama's term, but looking, say, a decade or more ahead, where do things need to head? What needs to happen next in relations between the U.S. and Israel in those years?
Well, as I said, I remain pretty much an optimist when I look at the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And the reason I say that, as I said, is because fundamentally, Israel is the only democracy in the region. And whatever differences or difficulties it has, it's a government based on the rule of law, on institutions, and accountability. You have, I like to say, in Israel, you have regularly and unregularly scheduled elections where the loser accepts the outcome. That's really kind of the hallmark of democracy, and you really don't find that in the Middle East. So that sets Israel apart, and that's why I think fundamentally we'll see the relationship remain on a pretty solid footing. Will there be differences? Potentially. But I think I expect that the next administration will probably have fewer differences with the Israeli government, in part because the next administration will want to show that it's able to manage the relationship a little better, and the Israeli government will want to show that the reasons for the difficulties that existed were not from their end, but were more from the Obama administration's side. So I think there's a kind of likely impulse on both sides to try to manage the relationship more effectively. And I do think if you're looking out over the next decade, it's precisely because of the turmoil in the region that we're likely to find it even more in our interest to be managing and working with the Israelis closely, particularly at a time when the Israelis are likely to continue to be working increasingly closely with many of our traditional Arab partners in the area. There is one last interesting irony I'll point out. Precisely because both the Arabs, the key Arab states, and the Israelis looked at the Iran deal the same way, precisely because both are deeply suspicious of what the Iranian intentions are, they have come to work much more closely together, even if it's below the radar screen. There's very much of a common perception of what the U.S. is now doing. I often joke that when I say I go to the region, if I put a blindfold on, I don't know who I'm talking to because what I'm hearing is exactly the same.
Dennis, this is John again. One final question I have is, one of the linchpins of major American Jewish organizations, not all, but almost all, is support for a two-state solution. You mentioned a two-state solution earlier. Do you believe that current Palestinian leadership, I know it's divided between Hamas and Fatah, but that at least among the leaders of Fatah and potential successors to Mahmoud Abbas still believe in a two-state solution?
I think they do, but if you look at the polling among Palestinians, we've now seen, and I think this is a function of the basic disbelief that it's going to happen, we've now seen that a plurality now favor a one-state outcome. That could be turned around, I believe, if you can reestablish the sense of possibility, which is now missing. But I think at a time when secession is looming, where a lot of Palestinians are talking about secession to Abu Mazen, I think you're going to find that during those kinds of periods, there's more of a tendency to see who can be more pure and extreme rather than who can be more accommodating. So even though I think that fundamentally those within Fatah favor a two-state outcome, there really isn't anybody out there who's prepared to adopt public positions at this point that move you in that direction. It's why I'd like to see an administration focus more on getting both sides to take steps that show that they're prepared to demonstrate in deed and not just in words that when they say they favor two states, they actually are manifesting it in terms of their behavior.
Dennis and John, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ambassador Dennis Ross is the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. John Euclid is a former Brooklyn, New York, assistant district attorney and president of the Victor Corporation, also past president and board member of the Jewish Community Relations Council. Ambassador Ross is going to be the featured speaker at the Jewish Federation of Cincinnati's annual meeting, June 21st. He'll be talking about the future of relations between the U.S. and Israel in the aftermath of the Iran nuclear deal and changing alliances in the new Middle East. And you can find a link to more information at WVXU.org. Coming up, we'll talk with Jim Obergefell and Debbie Sensipper about their new book, Love Wins, which tells the story behind the Supreme Court decision to legalize same-sex marriage. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.